Dottle Talks Tech, episode number 31. Finally, Freddy. Dottle.
It's Dottle Talks Tech with James DeRuvo.
Never touch another man's butt.
Online at DottleNews.com.
On this episode of Dottle Talks Technology, I have one of the trailblazers on YouTube, Freddie Wong, joins us.
Hey, what's up? I want to go for that one. Go and say trailblazer, just the dude making videos.
Yeah, but come on. Let's face it. You were pretty much on the ground floor. I mean, maybe not a pioneer per se, but you've been on the ground floor of basically doing it full time on YouTube.
Yeah. I mean, we started since 2010, so this has been pretty much my life for the last 4 years.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, your very first YouTube video was about poker.
Let me think, actually. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Back Aces. In the days when you were at USC, if I remember.
Yeah, that's right, a video called Aces.
And you guys, like, somebody cheats and next thing you know, you're pulling out guns and shooting each other.
Yes, that was shot in our dorm break room over the course of an evening, of a bored evening.
What made you want to get into filmmaking?
I was in high school, actually, so that was kind of how it started. I started in high school, and I was making movies on mini DV with the iMac, because those two things were in place at the time, and that allowed you to do, you know, you could edit and you could cut things together on like iMovie and then Final Cut, and that was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. It was a good way of sort of. It was a good weekend activity. It was a good way to get, you know, friends together. And it was just such a good experience. I wanted to keep doing that. And was so interested in that process and that social sort of side of it. And the fun of having a final product and exhibiting it and everything. So it was very much from my high school experiences. And it's just have kept it going. I've always been watching movies, you know. So my family's a big movie watching family. And I've always just been interested in cinema.
I remember the first video that you and Brandon did that I saw was the one where you're walking down an alley and these guys show up with guns and you call time out.
Yeah. Time crisis way back in the day.
Stop. And I go, what the
heck? Yeah.
It was so bizarre, but I hit subscribe right away because I just thought it was hysterical. And okay, so you've been doing this. Has it only been 4 years?
Yeah, but that's like internet years, man. Like internet years last forever.
Yeah, that's true.
Like that's like saying that I've been doing something for 15 years.
Yeah. So you went to USC Film School.
Yes.
And then you started. You decided not to do the whole PA thing and blah blah blah. You just went right into making movies.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah, exactly. The goal right away wasn't to be like, oh, sort of work your way up. To me, it was like, well, I have a camera, and the camera's good, and we can start shooting stuff, and we have computers, so what are we waiting for here, you know? And so it was just right away just working on movies or you know, in a capacity beyond just sort of like on-set PA. Early on, one of the first things we did was Sam and Nico of Corridor Digital had shot a really low budget horror movie for the directed DVD market. And I basically quit my job at Fox to get on board and help them do music and sound design and sound mixing for it. And that was sort of the beginning of just being like, all right, let's just focus on doing whatever it takes to make movies.
Now you not only show the distinction of being an internet filmmaker, but you were also, if I read this correctly, a Guitar Hero champion.
Yeah, for a second, I'm really good at Guitar Hero. So for a second, I played Guitar Hero professionally, and like by for a second, I mean like one summer.
There's like a professional.
There was a little pro gaming scene for rhythm games for a hot second, and that was sort of the inspiration a little bit behind the character that I play on Video Game High School is the idea that rhythm gaming once was this thing and then now no longer is. It's very truthful to the world of pro gaming. So I did that for a second, and then I stopped because there really wasn't any reason to keep doing it. But it was a lot of fun while I was doing it.
And then you covered the Olympics.
Yeah, so that was 2010.
For Samsung.
The winter. Yeah, so Samsung had a video contest, And one of my friends from film school, one of the guys who's actually now working with helping us out and working on one of the writers on one of our shows and producers on one of our shows, he basically said, well, hey, there's this thing, the Samsung contest. Do you want to give it a shot? Yeah, give it a shot. Let's do it. And that was where – so basically it was a bunch of people – up in Vancouver to cover the 2010 Winter Olympics. And I gone up there and met while we were up there, we met this guy named Daystorm. And Daystorm's a big Vine Instagram guy, but also at the time, big YouTube guy as well. And he basically was a partner. And we basically sat down and we're just like, hey, how does this work? How much money are you making on this? Can you make money on this? How many hits do you need, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he just basically sat back and said, yeah, this is how it works and this is the process and everything. And I was like, awesome, great. That was kind of what spurred us into doing YouTube stuff was we'd always kind of seen YouTube as this place for making videos and this place where we could build audience, but never really kind of knew the specifics until I met Daystorm.
And so he gave you pretty much the ground floor. Now I saw a video that you guys did when you went back to USA and gave a talk, and you were talking about how to make a living on YouTube. And
where was it? Oh, where was that
you
at?
Went back to USC.
And oh, yeah. I think
so. This nighttime talk that you guys
gave.
And so run us through it. It's like you got young filmmakers out there that are looking to make their splash on YouTube. Is it too late? Can they actually make their mark on YouTube now?
I think you can, but you have to do it in a different way. No, I think you can, and there's a problem is you have to do it a different way, you know? I think every single moment of YouTube's history, I've heard people be like, well, this is it. This is the end of YouTube, and you can't make a splash anymore, and you got to find something else. I've heard that. I've heard that now like four or five times. I heard that there would be nobody who grew as fast as we did, but then within a year, Epic Mealtime came out, and they did it faster. And I heard there would be no more vloggers anymore. And that was then vlogging was dead, and there was a completely saturated market. And then Jenna Marbles comes and beats everybody at their own game and does it faster than everybody. I heard there'd be no more gaming channels, and then gaming was sort of saturated, and you had like these guys already set. There's no way that, you know, XJaws and some of these old school gaming YouTubers. And then all of a sudden, PewDiePie comes and becomes the biggest YouTuber in the world, right? So it's not that it's impossible to make a splash on it. I think different types of content have different moments in time where it was easier or harder, but still not impossible. I don't buy that for a second because I've just seen it not be the case over and over again.
Yeah, but it's the age old question of how do you catch lightning in a bottle?
Well, I think the goal with the trick with that is to not think about catching lightning in a bottle, and also to not look at where lightning used to strike and holding your bottle over there, but to think about. That's really what it is. I think a lot of people chase trends, and a lot of people say, okay, this is what worked in the past, therefore it must work now. It's like, no. If you're going to sit here and look at the past and try and dictate your actions based on the past, you're not going to see the new thing, the new way of getting noticed, and you're going to miss that entirely, you know? And that's, you know, I think that's going to be up to you at any given point in time if you're someone new on it. I mean, we're very fortunate. We're incredibly lucky to be doing YouTube stuff and what we were doing at the time that we were doing it. I know, can tell you at the very least right now, our style of content, our style of thing, I think it would be as popular, and I think it would probably found an audience, but I don't think it would have found an audience as fast as it did when we were back then, back when there was sort of less people doing that, you know?
Now, it seemed to me that there was a moment where you guys shifted into high gear, and that was, at least as far as I can see, was when you did Cowboys and Indians spin-off with Jon Favreau.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so Cowboys and Aliens was basically a promo thing for his movie, and that was kind of right in the middle of the time. We were actually doing a lot of sort of branded stuff here and there. We had done like a Battlefield commercial and whole range of stuff. But yeah, no, I think that was, again, to me, looking back at it, you know, you can say, oh, okay, this is kind of a leap. But at the time, it was just very much like, oh, no, this is just the next project. And we always kind of looked at it from a project by project basis. And we weren't ever in a situation where we're like, okay, let's do, you know, we're trying to build up to something. It was just, no, let's just keep evolving and keep growing. And what comes next comes next.
Right. So it's not like it really was a plan, per se, like, you know.
Yeah, the plan was just to get better. The plan was to keep working at the skill set and improve. You know, that was really – and if there was a plan, that would be the plan.
Because I noticed after Favreau, then Elisha Dushku guest starred on one of your videos. And And it's just like you had like four or five straight stars popped into your videos for just little cameos.
Yeah. And it was kind of nice because we shot things so quickly that it became a place for actors to be able to kind of do whatever they wanted with very little time commitment. So we're able to do things like, you know, with the late great Andy Whitfield to be able to say, hey, you want to be like a gun action thing instead of doing like your gladiator thing. He was like all for it. And that was something that he always wanted to do.
Okay. And then VGHS came along.
Yes. So that was an idea. VGHS was an idea that was like 2009, like 2000 early. Yeah. So it's been around. VGHS was around even before we started doing YouTube. And at that point we were like, okay, we seem to have a pretty good audience, and you know, let's try and expand out the type of content that we're doing, and let's do VGHS as a long form series, you know? And it was very challenging to sort of figure out what the format would be, how we're going to put it out, all the, you know, sort of things about production for it. But, you know, I think it was again, the sort of natural progression. It was a natural progression for it.
But this is where you came. This is where you got in on the ground floor and the whole crowdfunding thing.
Yeah. So that was like, I remember when Kickstarter first came out, it was, you know, sort of very small scale projects. I had a friend in high school who made a Kickstarter for a documentary project that she was doing. And that's how I even heard about the site in the first place, because of that. And I was like, oh, you know, Kickstarter might work for this. And there was a couple other projects, like there was a Minecraft documentary, I think, that was on Kickstarter, but not a lot of movies and not a lot of web series at all. So we kind of like, all right, let's start a Kickstarter. And I think we were one of the first sort of large scale projects that sort of hit on Kickstarter.
Now, I noticed that you did something that I had never, ever seen before, and that was that you actually put out a report on where the money went.
Well, that was something that was always kind of funny, because we were always like, how much does this stuff cost? And I remember even producing when I was producing a direct-to-DVD movie, like being like, how much should you pay this guy, and what is the cost of this? You can't find it anywhere. Like, nobody talks about it. And I was like, that's weird. One, that's a useful resource. And two, why not? Why shouldn't people talk about this? Because we realized that people have a really bad idea of how much stuff costs. Like, if you say to someone, like, oh, this has cost $1 million. Like, they're like, whoa, $1 million. Then you talk to any film person, they say, that was it? $1 million? Like, oh, boy, that's low budget, you know? But to the average layperson,
it's like there's this old saying from politics. Where this politician said one time, a billionaire, a billionaire, pretty soon you're talking real money.
Yeah, exactly. and it was one of those things where people didn't know that. So if we were like, okay, if crowdfunding or just people financially supporting us is going to make any sense, they need to understand how much this stuff costs. Like, they can't be laboring under the illusion that this is just VGHS, that was a $75,000 show. It's like not even close. So no one else is doing it, so we figured, well, we should probably be the ones doing it. And it was good. I hope that it's been a good resource for filmmakers and people, you know, who are entering this space and trying to figure it out. And I hope that it's something useful for them, you know?
Well, I think the most valuable thing I got out of that report, I wrote about it for Dottle News, and the most valuable thing that I got out of it was the shocking amount of percentage of pledges that get denied.
Oh, that miss? You know, I think that always changes too. You know, I think that even changes over time. And I think that's something that is dependent. You know, again, that was numbers based on Kickstarter is a very brand new platform. And I think now as more people pledge and more people back things, that number is no longer as much as it used to be. But, you know, again, this is us trying to reflect the realities of production and the truths of what we are making and how much it cost as honestly, as clearly to our audience and our backers as possible.
Do you think that also kind of is indicative of the base audience that you have, which tends to skew younger?
I think it's an audience. I think if you were to make generalizations about that audience, I think the biggest one would be to just say that this is an audience that is not a media savvy audience. They're smart audience, and they're one that's hungry for information, and they're not one that generally, when presented with facts and truth, and you sort of say, this is how much it costs, their reaction isn't a negative one. It's, oh, okay, I get it. You know, they absorb. They're very good absorbers of information. So, you know, with that, you can't really pull anything over on them. You know, and you can't fool them and you can't trick them. So for us, we've always adopted kind of like, well, let's just be honest and be open with what we're doing.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to do it when you're dealing with that kind of, like you said, that media. It seems like everybody's media savvy these days. So you went from Kickstarter to Indiegogo for season two. Now, why did you make that change?
That was a couple of reasons. One was we had a big sort of international PayPal component to what we did from season one to season two. We had a lot of people in around the world being like, oh no, I can't get in on this because, you know, I have PayPal and I can't use Kickstarter. So that was one of the reasons, that was one of the ideas, was to sort of be able to hit that international crowd as well and open that up. And again, as you said, sort of younger crowd doesn't necessarily have credit cards, but the younger crowd may have access to a PayPal account. You know? So that was sort of one of the main reasons for it. There's a couple of reasons. Then also it was just, again, I think it was one of those things where we're always curious about platforms, we're always curious about methodology, and we're always willing to experiment with it. And so that was sort of the end result of that experimentation and sort of seeing like, okay, well, how about this platform? How does this work? And does this make sense? And does doing it this way make sense?
Can you talk about fulfillment, especially with you guys, because you guys are dealing with props and scripts and headsets and ID cards and T-shirts. That's a full-time job in and of itself when you're doing the rewards fulfillment for crowdsourcing.
Oh, no, for sure. I mean, that's the one thing that I think a lot of people miss when they talk about crowdfunding is that you also have to basically, depending on what you're doing, we had to create a fulfillment company, a full-on, you know, everything fulfillment company. We did everything. We did T-shirts. We did merchandise. We did apparel. We did, you know, school supplies, just anything and everything in between. And that was a whole full-time job that took on, you know, 3-4 people just to handle all the tech support and the customer service and the shipping, the fulfillment. Like, it's a big part of what you pay, you know?
So what kind of, someone's dealing with that big juggernaut of fulfillment, what were some of the lessons that you learned that they could take advantage of?
Early on, hire somebody who's familiar with this and listen to their advice when it comes to what rewards you offer, at what tiers, and the margins that you need to be making on them to justify it.
So don't just sit down and say, okay, let's offer a T-shirt, but actually go talk to a fulfillment company before you even start your campaign.
If you're aiming at success, you should be thinking about that stuff very early on, and just to get a sense of like how much this stuff's going to cost. Because, you know, even we are still shocked sometimes at some of the things that you wouldn't expect costing much more than you would anticipate.
And so you've got season three pretty much in the can now.
Yes,
and I noticed you've been hitting some cutting edge stuff. You started using the Movi.
Yeah, Movi was a lot of fun in season three. And that was actually the kind of thing where we did Steadicam on season two, and there were so many situations when we were outside where wind would start to mess with the Steadicam that we're like, I wonder if there's anything else out there. And then it turns out there is. And we did actually use Steadicam for a couple things still, but like Movi was actually ended up being one of the more interesting tools that we ended up using because of the stabilization that it provided. It was interesting. It was a lot like, because it stabilizes yaw and pitch, it doesn't stabilize like just straight vertical movement. So the handheld look that it gets is almost feels like what you see out of your eyes after your brain has stabilized you walking. You know, like there's a sort of weird smoothness to it that's familiar because I think it's very close to what we see through our eyes because our brains are doing kind of a lot of filtering out that the Movi does. It's a really cool look, and I like the fact that with a Movi you can transition from holding it high and holding it low quickly and easily, and that's something that generally don't need for dialogue stuff, but for action is something that you desperately need.
I like it that you can hand it off.
Yeah, you know, and I think the handoff feature is much more gimmicky than I think that, like, I've yet to see a handoff end up being anything that's even useful. You know, like I've seen some of the shots where they hand it off, and to me, most of the time, unless the purpose of it is just hand off, it's just almost like no reason for it cinematically. You know, we had a moment actually where we did a handoff where it came off of a jib, so it was a jib move from high up into a handoff up into, you know, 2 feet from the actors. But in the edit, it was like, well, this was a cool shot, but we only need the part where I'm walking up to the actors as the end result. There's no need to have this whole sweeping thing in. And I can see it working, and I can see a situation where it works, but I think those are much fewer and far between than the amount of handoffs that are happening right now with that tool necessarily justifies.
The one that I'm thinking of is when Burton Snowboards did this short where the camera in essence flies through the Burton factory.
And
they handed it off like 9 times.
Yeah, and I can see that, and I can see like the idea of, you know, in that, and then in that context, you know, that's a promo slash visual context, a commercial context almost, you know, and I think the needs from your camera in a commercial context is definitely a different set of needs than from a storytelling narrative perspective.
Now, you also shot in, you also been shooting in HFR.
So we've done a lot of your action. All the video game action was shot in HFR. We actually ran into some technical issues this season, which is why right now the HFR version isn't up yet. But that's kind of like the side effect of being a lot of times on experimenting with stuff more on the cutting edge is that, well, software often doesn't quite 100% support it. And you have to kind of figure out how to work around it. So, you know, a lot of the action stuff shot in 48. All the action stuff, actually, the video game action stuff shot in 48 and played back in 48. And, you know, we did that with season 2, and we're reconforming and working on that for season 3 right now.
Now, it seemed to me like from season 1 to season 2, the style of VGA just changed dramatically.
It went from a movie to a TV show.
Yeah, and then it's kind of subtly changed again.
So season 2 and 3 were definitely conceptualized as a single story arc, and we always thought of season 2, quote unquote, as a 12-episode season, and it made more sense, and it was a much more natural break in the middle of it to do 6 and 6. So a lot of times, I think I would look at season 3 less as season 3, but more of a continuation of the stuff that we set up in season 2. And, you know, I think naturally, obviously, we're growing as filmmakers, and our skill sets are expanding and growing as well, so... You know, I think there's definitely a shift, but I think overall the story that we want to tell arc-wise begins season 2 and ends in season 3. And season 1 is almost like a little prologue and preview into, prelude into it. You know?
It's like backstory.
A little bit, yeah.
I've also noticed over the course of the last year, a lot of the stars of VGHS are starting to show up in TV shows.
Yeah, I mean, so everybody's actually really good, and one of the side effects of being really good is you start to show up and stuff. So,
but I'm thinking every time I see one, I go, oh, you know what? The producers here are Freddie Wong fans.
Yeah, I mean, no, you know what? I'm not going to take credit for that. Everybody here was well working professional actors before they led their copious talents to what we were doing, and I think their trajectory was set long before they came into contact with anything that we did. I mean, they're all incredibly talented actors and actresses that we've had the pleasure to work with. So I definitely can't take any credit for getting them any sort of work. I think that their talent alone speaks for themselves, and they do just fine at acquiring that kind of work on their own, to be honest.
I've also noticed that you're also doing Vimeo's video on demand service.
Yeah, exactly. So we're always trying weird new stuff. So the idea was to do a Netflix style binge option right away, as well as doing the YouTube one a week, more traditional television style, so that we can accommodate people who want to just binge it and don't have time to come by every week. And we can also accommodate people who do want to sit back and wait a week and anticipate every new episode.
So this is the last season, though.
Yes, absolutely. Last season of VGHS, in live action form, at least.
Do we have breaking news?
No, we've been talking about it for a bit. We've been talking about doing it as an animated show for a while, just because we can do a lot of the video game action not requiring actual physical cars and people and tanks and stuff, and it's way easier that way.
And probably cheaper. Well,
oh, yeah. Animation. Well, yeah. But easier. Less work, at least, for us.
So, and then Lionsgate came a-calling.
Yeah, so Lionsgate was signed to us sort of between after season two, and you know, we've had a lot of conversations with various Hollywood entities, and most of the time the conversation goes, hey, we're so-and-so, and here's our digital strategy, and it's us going like, well, that digital strategy is stupid, and it's not going to work. And Lionsgate was the only one who came up to us and said, hey, we're Lionsgate, and help us figure out our digital strategy. We're kind of new to the space, and we don't know what works and what doesn't work, and maybe this will work and maybe this, but we're open to hearing about it. And that was the first time we actually be able to have a conversation. And they're very open to this sort of new world that we all now inhabit with regards to content and distribution and creation. And, you know, the deal that we struck with them allows us to do more. It allows us to do more in terms of live action, allows us to do more in terms of long form. It's the kind of stuff that we've always wanted to do, and the kind of stuff that the economics of which are very challenging on the YouTube platform. And, you know, a lot of times that's a lot of the reasons why it was very difficult to do seasons 1, 2, and 3 for Vegan High School is that each one of those seasons had a different profile with regards to how it was financed and how it was made. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of energy away from what you would ideally be spending working on making a good show, just to figure out the financing for it. So that the deal with Lionsgate allows us to step away a little bit from the difficulties and the nitty gritty of trying to figure out how to make long form work online and concentrate more on making the show itself.
So with VGHS wrapped up, what's next?
So a couple shows. We have a show called Dimension 404, which is like a Twilight Zone-esque anthology show that we're going to be doing. That another co-founder of the company, Des Dolly, is show running. And we also have an untitled reality show that we're kind of working on, but not like reality. I think more like sort of like it's not quite Spinal Tap, but more like, you know, sort of Parks and Rec, almost sort of a look inside of our offices and our process that goes into making our viral shorts. So we have a couple of other projects, you know, obviously VGHS animated show as well. But the idea is to expand out beyond what we did with Video Game High School, and not just do Video Game High School over and over again, but to do a whole range of genres and shows, and hopefully get people thinking about us not just as the guys who make VGHS, but as the guys who make a whole bunch of really cool stuff.
So have you moved on from the shorts?
No. So the part of the reality show is going to be able to let us get back to doing the shorts. And again, the difficulty with the shorts is just it's the economic side of it, and also the scale at which we want to do them. Again, makes it very challenging on the YouTube platform from a financial standpoint. So we're going to be we have some, and we have a lot of ideas for them that we're figuring out a way to make them and make it make sense financially.
So just a couple – and you also do this – is Node your channel?
No, it's not.
But they came to you and said, we want to do a channel with you where you play video games?
That's a whole separate thing. That's old. That's an old channel from that's just boring and complicated. And no, that's not – that was a thing. That was a gaming channel.
Like Guitar Hero, right?
It was like a gaming channel that was. I'm trying to remember the whole history of it. It was actually very complicated. But no, I don't. I have no part in Node anymore. Although I do enjoy playing video games whenever I have the chance to.
Yeah, but that's becoming further and farther between, I can imagine.
Yeah, I've noticed that less time to play video games these days.
And then you've also been showing up on television.
Yeah, here and there, which is kind of interesting. We were on Conan for Video Game High School to promote that, and again, it's sort of just like the old PR machine and getting on the tours and doing that. So we're on Conan to promote season 3, and I was on there with Matt. And yeah, you know, I don't think maybe too much on television. You know,
I noticed that YouTube is like all in on commercials now. I saw a television commercial from YouTube about VGHS, and then there's a gigantic billboard of VGHS right outside of Universal Studios.
Yeah, so there's this whole thing they're calling the Beacon Program. We're not the first ones being sent through it. They did epic rap battles. They've done some of the makeup gurus previously, but yeah, sort of this campaign to sort of highlight some of the content on YouTube that we've been very fortunate to be a part of. And that's been kind of a trip too, because, you know, again, we do something, we put it online, we don't really expect it to show up in the real world in any tangible way. It kind of shows up online and people know it online, and that's kind of its thing. So yeah, it's kind of interesting.
And then I also noticed this week that that Jimmy's Feast of Fiction was featured in the PR campaign for Hunger Games.
Oh, I you know what? This is how little time I spend back at my place. I hadn't
Jimmy's
heard about
his
that.
Brother.
I haven't heard about that. I got to go talk to Jimmy about that. I literally haven't heard about that. I've been at the office so much.
Blew my mind. I mean, I'm sitting there and I was like, oh, there's a new, they got this thing called Voices of the District or something. It's their, for Capital TV. So it's the whole vibe of watching, you know, living in that realm and watching TV. How would TV work in the Hunger Games universe?
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It's called Capital TV, and they had this like documentary series called Voices of the District, and there was one about PETA's Bakery.
Oh,
and it's your brother Jimmy and his partner. I don't remember her name. Forgive me. But
Ashley.
And they're making recipes from PETA's Bakery.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And it was actually really well done, but it like blew my mind. I was like, man, it's like getting everywhere now.
Oh, that's cool.
Are you going to go into any longer form? Are you pretty much into TV? Or are you actually looking to do any features?
I think features and series, you know, television like series is definitely something that we've been our next two projects are focusing on. But features as well is something that we have a lot of interest in doing. It's just a matter of finding the right story and figuring out the right way to do it. You know, so yeah, I think and basically though, it's just the concentration on long form and being able to spend time and sit down for our videos is hopefully kind of the goal that we've been focusing on.
All right. Well, my guest has been Freddie Wong, YouTuber, and now moving into mainstream television. Freddie, thank you for joining us finally on Dottle Talks Technology.
Yes, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Dottle Talks Technology. For more information, visit our website at www.news.dottleme.com. Got a question or comment? You can drop me a line at james@dottleme.com. You can like us on Facebook and also subscribe and leave us feedback on iTunes. Dottle Talks Technology is a copyrighted podcast from Dottle News. Thanks for listening.